Do you, Baron Frankenstein, take this woman to be your bride? Do you promise to haunt her with old horror movies, toys, and comics?
Yes, I want Fran. Woman. Fran.
And you, Baroness, do you take this man beast to be your lawfully bound husband? Do you promise to endure hours of unimaginable torture as he rambles about monster movies and long-dead actors? Close enough. Then by the power invested in me by Count Alucard, I now pronounce you supermates. You may bite or kiss the bride.
Hello and welcome to episode 40 of Supermates, the Husband and Wife Geekcast. I'm Chris.
I'm Cindy.
And today...
Me, not Shag. Cindy, me.
Yes. Hopefully that episode will have aired before this episode airs. I'm not exactly sure when that's going to air. Because I'm going to air as in a drop, I should say drop. Because, you know, it's according to when Shaq puts his episode up where we record it, because we're trying to coordinate things. But I think it should by this point. If not, people are going to be like, what the hell are they talking about? But anyway, if it hasn't come out yet, then keep listening. So we are in part three of the House of Frankenstein, and by the time this episode drops, we'll be in October proper.
Mm-hmm.
So it'll make more sense that we're doing Halloween-themed episodes. But again, we don't care, because we want to do as many as we can. As we record it this weekend here in lovely central Kentucky, it is kind of fall-like feeling mm-hmm. outside, so it gets you in the mood for that type of stuff. So you know, hopefully by the time October's here, it'll feel like that all the time. But real quick before we jump into the House of Frankenstein, I want to do a quick plug. Back issue number 84 should be out. That is an all Supergirl issue, Supergirl in the Bronze Age. That actually has an article by me on Supergirl merchandise of the Bronze Age. And it also has an interview with Alan Brennert conducted by our pal Rob Kelly.
Mm-hmm.
And it's actually from the Fire and Water episode where Rob interviewed him. And I'm not just saying this because Rob's my pal. That's one of the best interviews the back issue has
It doesn't read like your typical interview. It reads like a conversation. Which I know that... It's more of a give and take,
right?
Interview, you know what I mean?
Right. Yeah, it just feels like more of a natural,
mm-hmm.
natural interview. And I mean, I always enjoy the interviews in back issue, but that one's just an exceptional one. So, great job on that, Rob, which I've already told him. But so check that out and keep an eye out on back issue. There'll be more updates as far as from our end with some content on in back issue.
Also, you know, I thought your article about the Supergirl merchandise was really good, too, but, you know.
Oh, well, thank you. Well, I'm not going to brag on myself, but
I
had fun doing it, and I appreciate the help of several of my collector friends who I thank in the article who contributed photos and information, and it's all in the article there, so... I don't want to take up too much time here because you're not here to listen to Supergirl merchandise. But I also want you to go out and buy back issue number 84. So, you know, ask your comic shop or, you know, get a digital version online. But check it out. Back issues, one of my favorite magazines. And the only comic magazine I read on a regular basis. Mm-hmm. I pick others up here and there. But even if I didn't contribute to it, I'd always plug it because I really love it. So now we'll jump into what we're going to talk about today. And this is actually going to serve as our Christopher Lee tribute
mm-hmm.
Because we're going to talk about The Mummy from 1959. I struggled back and forth with what do we do as a tribute to Christopher Lee, because obviously Christopher Lee passed away a few months ago.
Right.
And of course, we were probably going to talk about Christopher Lee anyway. But that just cinched that, okay, we got to do a Christopher Lee movie. Last year we did Horror of Dracula.
Right.
Which is kind of the first thing you think of when you think about horror movie and Christopher Lee, you think of Dracula. And you particularly think of the first one. So we already covered that one. So I went back and forth and back and forth. And I kind of thought, well, I'll get into why I thought this one was the one to go with later. But I really do think this is a... It's probably not the first one that jumps to people's minds, but I really do think it's a it's a very good showcase for him, and we'll get into that why as we talk about it. This film actually continued the hot streak that Hammer had with the horror remakes in color that started with The Curse of Frankenstein, which had Christopher Lee and Peter Cushing, and was directed by Terrence Fisher and written by Jimmy Sangster. And then they did Horror of Dracula. And so this would be the third film that they did together that was a remake or a new version of a classic horror film. But those weren't really remakes of the Universal films. They came from the same source material. This film was actually made after they struck a deal with Universal. And so they were able to use the names of the characters from the Universal movies. So there's elements of The Mummy from 1932 with Boris Karloff, The Mummy's Hand from 1940 with Tom Tyler, and then the series of Mummy films that starred Lon Chaney Jr., The Mummy's Tomb from 1942, and The Mummy's Ghost and The Mummy's Curse from 1944. So there were two Mummy movies in 1 year.
Oh.
It's kind of weird. I think the one was supposed to come out. I think Ghost was supposed to come out in 43, and it didn't get released till 44. But, yeah. So there's elements, and we'll get into which ones they borrowed more from than the others. But these are the Universal characters. So this is actually the first official Universal remake that Hammer did. So The Mummy was released December 16th, 1959. Again, no Halloween.
Nothing says Christmas like a mummy movie.
Well, wrappings, I don't know. As we said, screenplay was by Jimmy Sangster and directed by Terrence Fisher. We have Peter Cushing, yay, as John Banning. Christopher Lee, yay, as the mummy. Karis, or they pronounce it so many different ways.
It depends on
which actor's saying it. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And Yvonne Furneaux as Isabel in another role, which we'll get into later. Mm-hmm. Spoilers. Eddie Byrne as Inspector Mulroney. Felix Almer as Stephen Banning. Raymond Huntley as Joseph Wimple. George Pastel as Mehmet Bey. Michael Ripper as a poacher. And George Woodbridge as a police constable.
Our scene opens Egypt, 1895. After years of combing the desert, archaeologist Stephen Banning believes he has located the tomb of Princess Anaka, high priestess of the god Karnak. Legend told that Anaka had died while on a long journey, a pilgrimage, and her party buried her in a secret place far from Egyptian civilization. Along with his brother-in-law, Joseph Wimple, Banning shares the news with his son, John. Joseph is concerned that his nephew's broken leg should be set properly back at the expedition's home base, but both Banning men are too obsessed with unearthing the tomb to delay, especially Stephen.
The entrance to the tomb is unearthed, and as Stephen and Joseph are about to enter, they are stopped by an Egyptian man, Mehmet Bey, who begs them to not desecrate Anaka's grave.
Mr. Banning!
I'm Banning.
I must ask you to stop these operations.
But I don't understand.
He must not continue digging here.
Why on earth not? We've got all the necessary permits, haven't we, Joseph?
I'm not interested in permits.
You're not from the Egyptian government?
No, I'm not.
There's no more to be said.
Mr. Banning, please, allow me to appeal to your reason. Believe me when I say that what you're doing places yourself and the rest of your party in the gravest danger. If you persist in continuing with this operation, I cannot answer for the consequences.
Nobody's asking you to, son. And now, if you'll excuse me.
Mr. Banning, you would do well to remember the ancient saying, Hal yisirk min kapr misr etwafa. He who robs the graves of Egypt dies. Now, for the last time, please stop what you're doing and leave this place.
And for the last time, kindly mind your own business. Come on, Judy.
Unheeding the warning, the two men enter the outer tomb, and Stephen cuts the rope and seal that bar the door. Inside, they discover a large sarcophagus, which Stephen confirms is indeed that of Anaka's. His lifelong quest ended, Stephen forgets to tell his son, so Joseph leaves to inform John. Stephen then finds a strange urn near the tomb. Inside is a rolled-up parchment. Banning recognizes this as the Scroll of Life. As he removes the scroll from its resting place, a hidden door opens.
While relaying the news, Joseph and John hear Stephen scream, and Joseph runs back to the tomb. There he finds Stephen lying over the sarcophagus, babbling incoherently.
Several months later, and Stephen Banning has failed to recover from his mysterious episode. He is currently residing in an asylum in England while a permanently hobbled John and Joseph finish up the expedition's work. With the treasure sent off to a museum in England, John ignites charges in the tomb's entrance, reburying it. Watching all of this is Mahepet Bey, who now possesses the Scroll of Life. He vows to unearth the tomb and set loose Karnak's revenge on those who desecrated Anaka's grave, even if it takes him years to do so.
Ingerfield, England, 1898. John and his wife Isabel visit the nursing home where Stephen has spent the past 3 years. They are shocked to learn he has seemingly recovered from the near catatonic state he has been in since that fateful day. For the first time in years, John is able to speak with his father. The reunion quickly turns into a warning from father to son.
You wanted to see me, Father?
Oh, yes. The mummy. I wanted to tell you about the mummy.
The mummy?
From Ananka's tomb.
She's in the British Museum, sir.
Not the princess, not her. It's the mummy who lives.
I'm afraid I don't understand.
The mummy I brought to life when I read the scroll.
There was no other mummy.
And don't talk rubbish, man. I was there. I saw it myself. It came from the rock when I read the scroll.
What scroll?
The Scroll of Life. After 4,000 years, the words of the scroll brought it to life again. It hates us, John. It hates us for desecrating the tomb of its princess. It will kill us! It will kill us, all of us!
Oh, no, you mustn't upset us. Stop thinking about it. Nothing really happened that day, you know.
You're a fool, John. Thank you for coming.
Goodbye, Father.
Remember, John, someone has found the scroll. The mummy is released again.
Later that night, two delivery men are discussing their latest job in a local tavern. Their mysterious client has asked them to deliver what he calls relics from his native land of Egypt. The two drunken stereotypes head for the man's house with a large crate. At that exact instant, Stephen becomes alarmed as the carriage nears his nursing home. Babbling about the mummy, he becomes so rattled he breaks his room windows, crying for help. Spooked by this, the drunken men nearly crash their wagon and lose their cargo in a swamp below.
The following morning, a party attempts to unearth the box from the bog with no success. A local police constable is a bit flummoxed to find the box's owner isn't too torn up about it. That man's name is Mahomet Bey.
John again visits his father's nursing home. The home's administrator believes Stephen suffers from a persecution complex, fearing that someone is out to kill him. Worried he may try to end his life after his violent outburst, the doctor has placed him in a padded cell. John cannot fathom this, believing his father doesn't have an enemy in this world.
That night, Mahomet Bey returns to the swamp. There he prays to his god Karnak and reads from the Scroll of Life.
Ek Imka et Amtak Kada, Amtak et Karnak, Rumtak Gester, Im Tohab, Tohab et Karnak, Edam Notap.
The swamp waters begin to turn and bubble. Slowly, a human form rises from the waters.
Eternal Ka the double, O Ba the soul, pulse strong O Ab the heart, make supple the limbs and strong the sinews. Refill, O my soul, this heart with tenderness, that ye may walk again the land of Kem in all thy strength and beauty, and wear once more the Ureret.
It is the mummy, shambling to life to meet the orders of the man who commands him.
In his padded cell, Stephen is startled awake as the mummy breaks the steel bars and metal mesh which cover his window. The old man cries for help, go unanswered, as the mummy chokes the very life from his body.
With his death ruled a murder at the hands of parties unknown, John and Joseph try to discover who had once Stephen dead. They comb through his exhaustive records, with John pondering if there wasn't something to what his father warned him about concerning the mummy. John reminds his uncle that they really have no idea what made Stephen's mind crack during his few moments alone in the tomb. From his father's folio, John relays the legend of Princess Ananka to Joseph.
In the year 2000 BC, the Princess Ananka, high priestess of the Temple of Karnak, set out on a pilgrimage. She was bound for Amtak, the reputed birthplace of her god. The great procession traveled for 3 months when the princess was stricken with a sickness from which she died. The body of the princess lay in state in her own tent while the involved and lengthy mourning ceremonies took place.
I am come unto thee, O Osiris, who art cleansed of all impurities. Thou goest round heaven. Thou seest Ra. Thou seest the beings who have knowledge. Behold, thou art in the sextet boat as it goeth round the horizon of heaven. Prosper thou for me all the ways unto thee. Homage to thee, Osiris, thou mighty and beneficent being, thou holy God, thou Prince of Eternity.
Carus, high priest, presided over Ananka's burial rites. He chose to go against tradition and bury her in the area where she died, rather than return her back to her Egyptian kingdom. Many of the burial party are sacrificed to either ensure their secrecy or continue their roles as servants to Ananka in the afterlife. Following his princess's final burial, Carus entered her tomb, breaking the sacred seal.
In life, the princess had been loved by Carus. It was a forbidden love, the high priestess being bound by all vows to the god Karnak himself. But now Ananka was dead, and the vows were no longer binding. Carus now attempted the ultimate in blasphemy. Using the timeless scroll of life, said to have been written by the hand of the god Karnak himself, he tried to bring back to life the princess he loved.
O thou Lord of souls, O thou Lord of the tomb, thou mighty one of Amentet, let not these limbs be without movement. Let them not pass away, and let them not suffer from corruption. Make supple these limbs and strong these sinews. Refill, O my soul, this heart with tenderness, that she may walk again the land of Khem in all her strength and beauty. Give life. Give life when I pronounce the mighty word of power.
As he prepares to revive his lost love, Carus is discovered by his people. For his blasphemy, Carus' tongue is removed, so no one could hear his screams during the final phase of his punishment. He was wrapped in bandages and buried alive near Ananka's tomb to guard her in death.
As John tries to convince Joseph there may be something to this legend, in his home, Mahatma Bey again prays to Karnak and sends the mummy Carus after the second of Ananka's offenders. As he stalks the countryside, Carus is spotted by the local poacher, who then stumbles into the nearby tavern and rambles about what he has seen. At the Banning estate, Carus bursts through the front door and immediately sets his powerful hands at Joseph's throat. He knocks John away as he murders his uncle. His task complete, Carus walks away, with John firing several bullets into him with no effect.
The following morning, Police Inspector Mulrooney and John discuss the previous night's events. When John tells him of the mummy, the inspector is of course not convinced. John then tells him of his theory on what exactly drove his father mad, how his father must have found the Scroll of Life and upon reading it brought Carus back to life. The sight of the living mummy unhinged Stephen's mind. Mulrooney is even less convinced than before, but John warns him he fears he himself is the next on the murderer's list.
While investigating the case, Mulrooney speaks to the poacher, the two drunken delivery men, and the police constable, giving some amount of credence to John's tale. In his shrine to Karnak, Mahabin Bey again unleashes Karras, this time out to murder John Banning. In his home, while reviewing his father's records, John points out to Isabel how much she resembles Anaka, especially with her hair down. When John tells her he believes he is to be the next victim, she begs him to leave, but John feels that with no one believing him, he must face his attacker alone. Although he is waiting with a loaded shotgun when Karras arrives, it does little good when he crashes through the window. He takes two shotgun blasts to the chest, but still comes after his prey. A spear through his stomach doesn't do any better. Only when Isabel screams does he stop. Turning to look at her, he sees the princess he loved and approaches her. When she is repulsed by him, Karras turns away, a sadness displayed in his eyes.
Inspector Mulrooney is beginning to come around to John's notions about the mummy. When he mentions the Egyptian man who hired the delivery men, John jumps at this as far more than a coincidence. The inspector preferring to take a slower approach, John visits Bay's home on his own. Believing John is dead, Bay is surprised to see his caller. Under the guise of a neighborly visit, the two men verbally spar over the role of archaeology versus religion.
I remember the opening of Princess Ananka's tomb. She was high priestess to a pagan god, Karnak. We have reason to believe that over 100 people were put to death during her funeral rites.
Most probably.
And Karnak wasn't a particularly important deity, a third-rate god.
Not to those who believed in him.
Perhaps not. But their standard of intelligence must have been remarkably low.
Why do you say that?
He was insignificant. He had nothing to commend him to anyone with the slightest degree of intelligence.
But surely you're assuming a great deal.
I don't think so. I made an extensive study of this so-called religion. It's based upon artificial creeds and beliefs, some of them ludicrous in the extreme.
Did it ever occur to you that beneath the superficial you've learned about, there could be a great and passionate devotion to this god?
Well, it occurred to me, but I dismissed it.
You're intolerant, Mr. Banning.
Not intolerant, just practical.
Intolerant. Because you're unable to experience the greatness of a deity, you dismiss it as of no consequence. But believe me, to those who worship and serve Karnak, he is all-powerful.
Surely there can't be people who still have such beliefs.
Now you talk about something of which you know nothing. You've scratched only the surface, and you know nothing. You assume the right to disturb the everlasting peace of the gods. You pry and meddle with unclean hands and eyes. Profanity, blasphemy, religious desecration, all these you are guilty of. But the powers with which you have meddled do not rest easy. I think you will not go unpunished.
Punished? By who?
There are certain things for which civilization has no answer. But if you choose to meddle thus, then you must be prepared to face the consequences, whatever they are.
Consequences? It sounds like a threat.
You must excuse me, Mr. Banning. We like to think that our European dress, our liberal education have buried the past. But occasionally one is forced to realize that all this is only a veneer. Thousands of years of traditional belief cannot be dismissed in one generation. Please accept my apologies.
Please. I should apologize to you. After all, I only came here to welcome you. I'm afraid I got rather carried away. I mustn't detain you any longer.
Mulrooney is not happy with John's rash action, but both are convinced Bay is connected to the murders. With two guards around the house, they await the arrival of the mummy to finish his work, but Bay himself takes out the two guards by stabbing them. Outside with Isabel, Mulrooney investigates a noise as knocked out by Karras, because he leaves her there by herself, duh. Bay and Karras enter the Banning home, where once again, John is no match for Karras' superhuman strength.
Only when Isabel calls for him does he pause, but he doesn't stop until she lets down her hair and commands him to do so. Mesmerized by what he believes is his princess, Karras refuses Bay's orders to kill her. When Bay attempts to murder her himself, Karras grabs him and snaps his spine, killing him and taking the scroll. Isabel passes out, and Karras takes her in his arms and shambles away. John and Mulrooney follow them into the swamp where Karras attempts to return to his tomb. A local posse has arrived with rifles, but they cannot fire for fear of hitting Isabel. As Karras walks deeper into the swamp, John calls to her.
Isabel! 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 Tell him to put you down. Tell him, Isabel, quickly!
Karras? Karras, put me down.
Let's get around the other side. Tell the men to be ready.
Stand by, men. Be ready.
Put me down. Karras, put me down.
Start walking towards me, slowly. When I shout, get down as low as you can. Now, Isabel! Fire!
Blasted by multiple rifles and clutching the scroll of life, Kara shambles forward but eventually stops and sinks into the bog from which he emerged. I really like the opening sequence, the title sequence with the hieroglyphs, and then the score by Franz Reisenstein, I believe it is. It's really powerful. It says ancient Egyptian, but it's not like too over the top. It still feels like a Hammer movie.
Right.
But it's just got a little bit of that flavor you want, you know. Of course, you've got the art direction by Bernard Robertson. He continues that tradition of making a little look like a lot. Because, you know, these movies didn't have very big budgets, but they look like they do.
Right. I mean, all of the things that they showed, you know, as they're doing the funeral procession and all that stuff, I'm like, man, where did they get all this stuff?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's impressive. And now there is one thing we'll bring up later that, but for overall, I mean, because, you know, you forget, I mean, unless you're just looking at it with a super hypercritical eye, you forget that they're, like, on a soundstage.
Right, right.
You know, they do a really good job of, especially, like, at the camp with the tomb and everything. And it's probably because they don't try to show you too much. They just try to give you enough in the camera to say, they're in the
desert.
This
is where we're at.
Yeah. They're in the Egypt. This is a camp where they're at an excavation dig. And it's just, but that's the genius of Hammer. They make these small budget movies look like lush productions. Some of the notes on the cast: Felix Almer, who played Stephen Banning, John's father, was a frequent collaborator of Sir Laurence Olivier, and was also knighted himself, as was Christopher Lee later on. But you know, where's Peter Cushing's knighthood? I mean, come on, you know, what's the deal with that? In fact, Almer, Cushing, and Lee all appeared in Olivier's Hamlet, although the latter two just had bit parts.
Right.
But even more interesting for horror fans, Raymond Huntley, who plays Joseph, was the original stage Dracula in the Hamilton Dean play. So he was the first official Dracula actor. I think Stoker put on like one show of Dracula in his lifetime to basically get the rights to it. But other than that, which was he? Because he was the manager of a theater in England, Stoker. But so Huntley was the first actor when the Hamilton Dean play was launched. He was the first actor to play Dracula, and he played it all through England. And eventually moved to London and was a big hit when they went to move it to the U.S. Apparently, he asked for more money. And the producer said no, so they went looking for an unknown actor here, and they found a Hungarian actor named Bela Lugosi to play Dracula. When Universal came knocking for the film adaptation, apparently they used Huntley as a bargaining chip to keep Lugosi's fee down. So he has a history with Dracula, although he never appeared, you know, as him on screen.
On film, right.
Yeah, but so it's kind of a neat little callback there with him being in this, especially since it's in a roundabout way connected to the Universal movies. I'm a bit confused about Joseph, speaking of him, because in the credits it lists his last name as Wimple, but he's said to be John's uncle, and at one point John refers to him as his father's brother.
Right.
But unless he's a half or stepbrother, I kind of just guessed he was his brother-in-law.
Right. And I mean, at that time, people didn't say, this is my brother-in-law, blah, blah, blah. They just called him, that's my brother, you know.
Could be. Yeah. So he's, you know, he's maybe the brother of John's mother.
Mm-hmm.
So just within the first few minutes, Sangster and Fisher set up who these characters are. You get it very quickly. We learn all you need to know about Stephen, John, and Joseph. Stephen is obsessed with his search.
Mm-hmm.
John is a devoted son who's not going to disappoint his father. And Joseph is a sensible one.
Right.
It's like, you guys are crazy. He needs to get his legs set. He's going to be crippled the rest of his life.
Right.
And he is. He's got a limp from here on out. George Pastel, who is as great as Mohammed Bey, he has the distinction of showing up in another Hammer Mummy film, The Curse of the Mummy's Tomb, in a very similar role, as I recall. I haven't seen that one in a long time. He's also in the James Bond film From Russia with Love, and in the Doctor Who story, Tomb of the Cybermen, which I think is, if it's not the first Cybermen story, it's very early.
Really?
I think it's 1967. I think that's the second Doctor. That's Patrick Troughton, I believe. As much as I admire Bernard Robinson, as we said before, the doors to the tomb...
Oh, they were cardboard, man. I mean, that was maybe really, really, really thin particle board?
Yeah. They seem really thin and flimsy. I mean, that's like you would expect these big stone doors that they'd have to have a group of men pull open, you know. But no, it's the two old guys just cut a rope and open it, and the handles look like they come from Home Depot.
It looks like, I mean, it doesn't even look high. That is true. That was the one part that I was really disappointed by. It doesn't even look like high school production good. It looks like middle school production. Yeah. I mean, I'm just like, whoa.
Yeah, that's the one thing that jumps out at you. Like, okay. And you know, you think they would, because they show up like in three different scenes
yeah.
That they would have put more thought and time into it. I'm really not sure why they blow the entrance.
I even said that too. Why did they do that? Because they'd taken everything out of it that mattered.
Yeah, they gutted it. So why not just leave it open? I mean, is this their way of being quote unquote respectful?
No, I don't think so.
They took everything of importance out. So now we're going to close it back up just like you guys wanted. Of course, there's nothing in there anymore, but you know, which of course is the whole crux of the movie, really. Maybe it was just to give Bay something to do for a few years so that story could, you know, jump ahead so the curse would, you know, if the curse happened next week, it wouldn't have been that big of a deal.
Right.
But I mean, it obviously would have been a big of a deal, but it wouldn't have as much impact as it you know, they go on with their lives and then 3 years later, all this stuff comes back to haunt them.
Right.
You know, so they had to give them something. I think it's funny, and other people have brought this up, Cushing's bum leg is an ironic twist on the Universal Mummy films because, you know, Chaney had he invented the stereotypical mummy walk with the bum leg because Karras got burned up in the mummy's hand, which was the one with Tom Tyler. So Chaney always played him that way. He had a bum hand and a bum arm and a bum leg, but he somehow managed to catch up to everybody that he was chasing.
Michael Myers,
Jason. Which, you know, a lot of people say especially the Chaney films, the prototypical slasher film. I mean, the way they stalk their prey, they go after them, and they people run from them. They can't get away from them. It's this lumbering, silent killer. You know, the way Lee's portrays it, he's not so much lumbering as he's just like. He's like a freaking bulldozer.
Right, he's coming.
He's just coming, but...
Slow and steady, man, slow and steady.
Yeah, but we'll get into that in a little bit. But it's funny, though, because now the hero has the limp, which is interesting. And then, of course, it wouldn't be a Hammer movie without two drunken guys in a tavern.
Oh, yeah.
Which is why I call them the, you know, stereotypes.
I can agree with that.
You pointed out, I thought this was interesting, that the arrival of the mummy in England...
Mm-hmm.
Seems to have awakened Stephen, his addled mind. Yeah, it's like the very presence of him has caused some alertness in him. So it's kind of neat. It's kind of like there's an extra little added bit to the curse you know, that his proximity has done something to his mind.
Right.
You know, so it's like there's more there than just him literally going to come after him and kill him. Because he goes back crap and breaks out his windows and everything, so.
But doesn't push the damn button.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, they go through this whole thing, the attendant's putting him to bed, and he's like, now, listen, you can scream, you can holler, you can beat on the walls. We can't hear you, but if you push this button, somebody will come. What's the first thing he does when the mummy comes? Go whop on the walls, and I'm going to scream. What's the one thing they told him not to do?
In direct opposition to the Universal movies, where everybody pushes every damn button and lever. You know? Don't touch that lever! Don't push that switch!
You know, I mean, last time
we had, you know, Elsa, you know, pulled the switch and he's like, don't pull that switch, you know. But he won't push the button. It's a history eraser button, you fool. What'll happen? I don't know. Maybe something bad. Maybe something good. I guess we'll never know. You won't touch it, will you? The shiny candy-like button. Oh, sorry. A Ren and Stimpy moment, sorry.
Slightly off topic.
Off topic. George Woodbridge, who played the constable, shows up in a lot of Hammer films, and we talked about him last year. He's in The Horror of Dracula as the innkeeper who warns Peter Cushing to stop snooping around.
Mm-hmm.
You know. You paid for a meal, sir, and you got it. Blah, 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 that guy. The scene where Bay raises Karis from the swamp is very well done and very eerie. I really like that.
Mm-hmm.
It's cool. But according to IMDb, the mummy walk that Lee uses, especially in that scene, wasn't entirely acting. He apparently injured his shins and knees on the pipes in the studio tank that was doubling as the swamp because he couldn't exactly tell where they were the way he was. You know, he's walking underwater, coming up, and banging himself around as he came up. So, because he does that kind of thing where he's like, he's almost up and then he raises up. And when he does, he kind of like shifts around. It kind of makes you wonder if he didn't just whack his knee.
And kind of like, oh, shit. But I'm not going to save it.
And the makeup by Roy Ashton, it's really nicely done on his face. Because as you watch through the movie, he's got several different textures going on. Because right now he's all swampy and muddy. He's covered in mud. Later on, he dries off a little bit. But it's like dried mud. Then you got the flashback to when we see him in the tomb with Stephen, and he's completely dry. So there's several different.
And even when they first put him in the tomb, it's even different then.
Oh yeah, definitely then. So. Yeah. So yeah, but I mean, it's well done, and that's an attention to detail that sometimes in these type of movies is forgotten. You know, which I like. You get the first glimpse of the incredible eye acting that Lee does in this film when Bay mentions the princess. His eyes go like from a glazed over mind control zombie to like they just kind of dart alive when he says princess.
Yeah.
It's real cool. And there's a lot of that in this movie, which we'll get into as we go along. Like we said, you know, he is just an unstoppable killing machine. When, you know, you see that when he first breaks into Steven's padded cell. I mean, he rips the bars off the window and he crashes through the glass. And then, I mean, and knocks that mesh off and slides in there and just goes to work, man. He ain't messing around.
And that's what kills me. I mean, he sees the guy up there. And, I mean, all he's got to do is reach up and hit the button. But he gets out of bed, even though they told him, don't scream, don't holler, you know, we won't hear you, don't bang on the walls. If you push the button, which is right over your head, we'll come.
Now, if you want anything in the night, just ring this bell. And it's no good shouting or banging on the door, we won't hear you.
But I'm going to wait while the mummy's going, whoa, whoa, whoa. I mean, he's got like 2 minutes of screen time to push the damn button right over top of his head.
He's an addled old man that's been in a catatonic state for 3 years.
I don't care. There's a mummy coming in to get his rear end. Push the button.
It's a mummy button. Then we get, you know, of course, after he's murdered, after Stephen is murdered, John and Joseph comb through all of his records to try to find out if there's anybody that had any grudge against him. And John tells the story of Ananka. And the flashback to her burial is nicely done, but I think it may go a bit long.
It's documentary feel.
Yeah, it does. It feels like it
this
feels
is
like
how Egyptian burials.
Walt
were
Disney
done.
World presents Egyptian burial. I mean, that's what it feels like. You know, it's you know, the wonderful world of Disney shows you how to, you know, how the Egyptians buried their, you know.
Well, and I thought, you know, when they were doing that, they show you. I mean, Hammer films, you generally have some TNA.
Right.
I mean, that's generally what you're looking for.
Yeah.
But in this one, I mean, you can tell that they are showing Anaka's nude body.
Yeah.
But it's covered by pillars and posts, and you're like, well, what was the point? Why, you know?
This is early Hammer, though.
I know.
Were you disappointed?
It's not that I was disappointed. I was just expecting. And I was like,
I was disappointed. No, I was like, ow. If it's Hammer in the 60s, maybe in the very late 60s they started to get into that, but it's in the early, late 50s, early 60s, like this is 59. Yeah, they show plenty of cleavage, but they, you know, and actually there weren't even a whole lot of cleavage in this one. But, now if this had been later Hammer, it'd been all, you know, there she is, you know.
Yeah.
You know? And in fact, there is a 70s Hammer mummy movie, which I haven't seen, but I bet you there's something going on there. I did like that we get to hear Christopher Lee's voice, because when you got a voice like that, it seems a shame that they waste it. Like in Curse of Frankenstein, you never hear it. And some of the Dracula films, he barely speaks. He never speaks in Prince of Darkness. He just growls. So it's nice that they did that. And even before it's revealed, if you listen to Lee's words and you watch his face, you can read that he loves Anaka.
Yes.
Which I like. I mean, that's another great bit of acting. You know, and it's, man, it is rough work working for the princess when she dies.
I know.
It's like beheadings and killing.
And what kills me is these women are like, yeah, I'm going to die.
They kill maidens, and so she'll, you know, they'll be with her in the afterlife. And you brought up a good point. Where are they at? You know,
where are their bodies at in the tomb?
Yeah.
Because I saw them leading out the Nubians. Those were the black males that
right.
were in there.
Yeah.
And I get that they slaughtered them, blah, blah, blah.
So they couldn't talk.
Right.
Yeah.
But the maidens, they would have been prepared, not in a sarcophagus, but according to Egyptian custom, they still would have been prepared and they would have been seen within the tomb.
Mm, they've been mummified too.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I don't know.
Not as well, but they still would have been mummified.
And he even says, well, there was no other mummy father, you know,
yeah.
So they apparently weren't there, period.
See, which doesn't make any sense why they killed him anyway.
Mm, I don't know. Yeah, and it wasn't, if this had been another, little bit later, which actually I'm kind of surprised there wasn't more blood in this, because there was plenty of blood in The Horror of Dracula.
Mm-hmm.
There wasn't any blood when you know, there's not any blood in this movie, really, if you think about
uh-huh.
it.
I don't think so.
It's like, maybe they, you know, the hardware store was closed. They couldn't go down and get the red paint they usually
Oh, yeah.
Sherwin-Williams is closed. It's like, oh, no blood in this movie.
Or corn syrup and food coloring.
Yeah. Now, I read on IMDb that, you know, it was as listed as a goof, but then listed, it's not really a goof, because Anaka's eyes flutter a bit.
I noticed that too.
As Karis is reading that, but it's a close-up of her. I think they would have either reshot or just froze on her.
Right.
If they didn't want her eyes fluttering. I think she was meant to, her eyes were meant to flutter to show it was starting to work.
Mm-hmm.
That's my take, and that's what somebody said on IMDb, which, you know, IMDb's not always right, but I think they were right, you know, there. You know, like I said, we probably would have seen lopped off heads and a severed tongue in a later Hammer movie, but, you know.
What kills me is he just stands there and takes it.
Yeah, well, I guess he, you know, he was the high priest. He you know, he knew the rules, so I guess he knew what he was getting into. I will say that as impressed as I was with the Lee's outfit and his makeup when he's the, you know, mummy in the present time, his clean wrappings aren't nearly as convincing. You can tell it's a suit.
Oh yeah, I kept looking for the zipper.
Yeah,
I did.
They did actually, I think, cover, although you can kinda tell where it is in the back, but it is covered up.
Yeah, I mean, but it looks like a zipper suit.
It's kind of like when they did a pretty good job with with Lon Chaney's not looking too much like a suit, although it, now, Karloff was completely wrapped, period, but
right.
He was only the mummy in like 2 minutes of the movie, which mm-hmm. is, you know, a lot of people's like, oh man, I mean, which is such a great visual, it just seems so weird that they didn't do more with it, but You know, I know by the time they did Abbott and Costello Meet the Mummy, that thing looks like he's just got a pair of pajamas on. It looks like he's got a quilted mattress top on him or something.
Which it was hilarious. Our little girl wanted to sit down with us and watch it. We're like, well, why do you want to watch this?
Yeah.
She thought it was the Abbott and Costello version. She's like, where's the guys, the big one and the skinny one? And where are they at?
Yeah, because
she was disappointed.
Well, we had watched Abbott and Costello Meet Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde last week.
Yeah.
And she thought, and I told her there was a mummy one. It's on the same set because there's a new Abbott and Costello Meet the Monsters DVD out there, guys. It's real cheap on Amazon. Go get it. It's got all four of the Meet the Monster movies if you don't have them. But she knew there was a mummy one. And we watched that once off TCM, but she probably doesn't remember.
Yeah,
And so she was thinking this was having Costello Meet the...
Yeah, I mean, the whole time. I mean, she's like...
I said at the end, it's like, oh, thanks. Good way to go. Now you made us late for our own movie. I'm a bad boy. You know what I'm saying? But, yeah, no Abbott and Costello, unfortunately, in this one. You got two drunken guys and Michael Ripper, but...
Yeah.
So the set that is in Bay's house is impressive with the giant statue of Karnak, who, what's he supposed to be? Looks like a fox or something. I don't know. I don't know what he's supposed to be. And, you know, you got the Karis cabinet over in the corner.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, you know, keep your mummies fresh. Flavor seal. Michael Ripper is Hammer's favorite utility bit player, although sometimes he's more than a bit player. But he shows up here as a poacher. The guys on 1951 Down Place are always talking about Michael Ripper, and of course Peter Cushing and Christopher Lee, but they're a champion of him. So whenever I see him, I'm like, hey, Michael Ripper. And apparently this is the only film where he appears with both Peter Cushing and Christopher Lee. Of course, he doesn't share any scenes with them, but they're all in the same movie. So there you go. Poor Christopher Lee injured himself further and dislocated his shoulder when he came through the front doors after Joseph.
Oof.
A grip had accidentally bolted the door, but he came on through and he went on with the shot, and that's what's in the film. So, I mean, when he tore through those doors, he was
tearing through the doors.
That's like they said, you know, and on the Adventures of Superman, you know, there's a story where one time they, you know, George Reeves came through. Nobody came through a wall better than George Reeves. Mm-hmm. I mean, nobody comes through a wall like him. That's a door, I meant wall. Anyway, they were working on an episode, you know, they had it down to a science, but they were filming, they had made a door, and they were supposed to shoot that scene, and something happened, they couldn't shoot it that day. So everybody went home, they come back in the next morning. Well, it had hardened more. And so George hit it and went about halfway through, and it come in through the other side. And I don't know if it was that one or the time the wires broke, but he apparently like, okay, good afternoon, and turned around, walked off the set, and it was done for the day. So, but you know, here Christopher Lee plowed on through and kept going. So there you go. That's commitment to your work. I do have a question. Why did John fiddle with the keys to the gun cabinet? It had glass.
Yeah, it had a glass front.
It had a glass front. All he had to do was take his elbow and bust through it. And grab it. He's fiddling with his keys while his uncle's getting choked to death out there. And it's like, oh, I must find my keys. No, that's to the rolls. No, that's to the outhouse. No, let's see. No, this one's to the china cabinet. Oh, damn, he's dead. Oh, shit.
Or, you know, they were in a room that had a fireplace. Pick up the poker and whop him, you know?
Yeah, I guess I understand wanting to get a gun, but, you know. Oh, well. Eddie Byrne, who plays Inspector Mulroney, appeared in another film with Peter Cushing playing General Willard. It's some little independent film you may know as. I've never heard of it. It's called Star Wars. I don't know what that is, but anyway. John's theory, when he's explaining it to Inspector Mulroney, fills in what exactly happened to Steven, but it's kind of weird because we, the audience, see Mehmet Bey order Karis back into his tomb, but John doesn't know anything about him yet.
Mm-hmm.
All he knows is his father said someone had the scroll and is in control of the mummy.
Mm-hmm.
But, so, it's kind of weird because we're seeing something, he's telling him a story, but we're seeing something that he's not telling him.
Mm-hmm.
So that was kind of an odd device. I don't know if that really worked. I mean, I guess it, you know, I guess it, I mean, it kept
it's giving the narrator knowledge that he would not have.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Well, it's like he doesn't even have it, but it's what we're seeing, which is, I mean, they do that sometimes in movies, but sometimes that takes me out of it because I'm like, wait a minute, he doesn't know anything about this guy yet. He hasn't even met that. He didn't even know that there's an Egyptian around yet at this point. Yeah. You had a good point, though, in that flashback scene. We were talking about this last night. Why didn't Bay just let Karis kill Steven there? Mm-hmm. You know, in the tomb that day. Right. You know, just choke him out there. And for that matter, why not set him loose and kill everybody in the excavation team? You know, come back and kill all the workers, kill John, kill Joseph, put him back in the tomb and be done.
I mean, even if it was a nighttime thing, I mean, maybe because, you know, that was during the day, and but they were within the tomb and could have killed at least Stephen.
And if he'd done all that, he could have stopped him from ever taking her out of the tomb. Mm-hmm. She would have never been taken away.
And that was the thing. It would have closed up the tomb right then because there was a murder on site.
Right. Yeah, well, or even if they killed him to where nobody knew what happened to him. Mm-hmm. And he sealed everything back up and did spoke. I mean, you know, it's like, of course, the movie would have been over like 20
minutes.
Not even 20 minutes, probably like 10, 15. So, but yeah, it's kind of like, it's like, you know, wow, it's like, I'm going to do this the hard way. I'm going to wait for 3 years and come travel to England.
And after all of the artifacts from my country are sent to England, then I'll take my revenge.
After they're stared at by people, you know, as he says later. Of course, Isabel looking like the princess is another element that goes way back to the original Karloff film. I mean, that's just become a mummy trope. There's got to, the leading lady is going to look like the Egyptian princess. It's just, it's as sure as the mummy being wrapped in bandages.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to happen, you know. You know, of course, Karis busts through the glass, which is, again, an awesome entrance when he enters into John's room to get after him. Plus, you get Lee choking Peter Cushing out again, like in Dracula. So, you know, he didn't make a run for the curtains and, you know, with the cool ending to Horror of Dracula, but still. And there's something about the way Peter Cushing, like, combs his hair back, and whenever somebody gets a hold of him and shakes him around, that hair goes everywhere. It adds a dynamic element to it. It's like his hair's flopping all over the place while he's getting, thrown around and flying over desks and everything. It's awesome. Apparently, the squibs, which, you know, are the little explosive things that put on people when they get shot in movies, when they went off, when Cushing's character shot Lee, they left burn marks on his chest. But again, he just kept plowing
through. Lee just got the beat the crap out of in this movie.
He's a tough old dude, though, man. That's lesser men would have called it quits, but, you know. Of course, now we know he did a lot of stuff in real life that this was nothing. This was walking apart for him. But the fact that Lee can emote through all that makeup when he sees Isabel, that's just a testament to his acting chops.
Mm-hmm.
And that is why I picked this one over Curse of Frankenstein or another Dracula. I mean, you honestly feel sorry for him.
Yeah.
I mean, you really do. That look on his, I mean, it's just in his eyes because he can't even move his mouth. I mean, you see the very minimal indentation of his mouth,
mm-hmm.
but he can't move his cheeks or any. I mean, it's just, you know, I mean, maybe
it's all through his eyes.
It's all, every bit of acting he does is through his body and his eyes. And I mean, it's just, it's fantastic. He even puts across his struggle with not being able to complete his mission when his master compliments him later, you know, which is really cool. You know, as far as sympathetic, I mean, it goes to show that Lee could play more than his Dracula was just an evil SOB. I mm-hmm. mean, that's the way they wanted him. And that's one reason I like him so well, because that's the way Dracula was in the book. He is just, there's no sympathy for his Dracula.
No.
He's got no redeeming qualities, you know. So, I mean, that's why I wanted to talk about this movie. The scene where Peter Cushing visits George Pastel, Mehmet Bey, at his house.
Oh man, that was a bait. He was baiting him the whole time.
Oh yeah, I love that. That was a very passive aggressive conversation there that turned into just aggressive.
But
nowadays, in these more culturally sensitive times, you can see Bay's
argument. Yeah.
I mean, he shouldn't be out murdering people, obviously.
No, but,
you know, I think back then it was probably more of, well, of course it belongs in a museum and all that stuff. But now it's like, you know, well, not everybody, you know, you're you're crapping all over those people's religion and their beliefs, and
you're taking things out of their country.
Right.
You know, even it's theirs.
I mean, their government approved of it, but at the same time, it's because he said they had all the permits. They weren't, you know, grave robbers or anything that wasn't doing it officially as far as that goes. But, I mean, in his eyes, they were.
Right.
It didn't matter that they had official sanction or not. But I thought that was, it was interesting. It was probably, it's probably more evened out now than it even was when the film was released, I imagine. Because, you know, we're just, you know, you're more aware of different cultures and their beliefs and things. I did point this out, and I looked again when I was doing the notes. Didn't Peter Cushing have a hat on when he came
in?
He did not pick it up when he left.
Oh, he didn't? Because I was wondering. I thought he had it in his hand because he's pulling on his gloves.
He was pulling on his gloves, but I did not see it in his hand.
Okay.
Which the guys...
Because I wasn't, you know, that was a point we talked about when we watched.
When Derek and the gang at 1951 Down Place talk about Peter Cushing, they call him Hot Props Cushing. Because apparently he liked to have a prop in his hand. That's why he smokes a lot in scenes. Mm-hmm. He's always fiddling with something. So he's putting his gloves on when he leaves, but I don't think he's got
his
hat.
Did Peter Cushing serve in the armed services?
I'm not sure.
The reason I ask this, and this is just something I noticed, but if you notice anybody that was in the armed services, particularly in, you know, up and through, say, the 50s or so, when they smoke, they tilt their cigarette in when they're holding it, and that's to hide the light of it. And he does that in a lot of the films where he's smoking. That cigarette is turned in. Unless he's actively smoking it, it is turned in, which is something that a military man or someone that has served in the military will do.
Seems like he probably, if I remember right, he did. I mean, he was obviously English.
Right.
And at his age, I imagine he was.
I mean, I just happened to notice that because
imagine
when he was doing
it. World War II.
Yeah. Because I saw when he was smoking that cigarette, every time he wasn't actively smoking it, it was turned in.
Yeah.
And that's something, they did that to hide the light. They did that, you know.
Yeah. But so. Derek and Casey and Scott always point out that you know, the props and things that he did. And now that they have, I'll watch it, you know.
Right.
I'll watch and see what he's doing, which as we haven't promoted enough. For your Hammer fix, go to 1951 Down Place. It's a great podcast. They talk about all Hammer films, not just the horror ones, but there's plenty of Hammer horror movies there to talk about. All year round they do it. That's a fantastic show. Go listen to it. So I got to ask, what kind of police force do they have in Ingerfield? All they've got, all they can round up on short notice is one constable and the local drunk poacher.
And what kills me is there is an asylum within the community, so you would think that they would have a police force in case they did have the nutties get out.
That's a good point. I even thought of that.
I mean, you know, there is a nut house that's there. It's an asylum.
Yeah.
For the mentally deranged. So you would think that they would need...
In these culturally sensitive times, we call asylums nut houses.
Sorry.
He's a nut. No, it's fine. So I think it's when Banning, when John's waiting for Karras to arrive, he knows he's coming for him. He's seen rubbing his neck, you know, because he tried to choke him already, you know, twice. And so I think that's interesting because, yeah, Peter Cushing does a lot of rubbing his neck in Hammer films. He's always looking out for his neck. Again, you get that look in Lee's eyes when Isabel lets her hair down. And then Bay orders him to kill her. I mean, it's just like his eyes dart over to him, and he's like, "Kill her!" And he just his eyes narrow, and it's just like,
"No,
I don't think so, buddy." And then he breaks him, you know, like Bane did Batman, except he gets the job done.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just like God. He just like, and the way he does it too is like he just lifts his leg up and grabs him by like his other arm and just like pulls that arm back, and you hear this. It's like, oh.
That hurt.
It's gruesome. It's like, ugh. But it's not no blood or nothing. I mean, you know, it's like there's no, yeah, it's just, wow. And apparently, again, poor Christopher Lee suffered yet another injury hauling Yvonne Furneaux around. He hurt his back. So, and that's a common, I mean, that's what happened to Boris Karloff. Hurt his back carrying Colin Clive around in the first Frankenstein movie.
Right.
So it's like, you know, all those monsters... Carrying, you know, we've talked about that before we talked about that when Linda Carter was carrying Lyle Wagner around on the Wonder Woman episode. That, you know, it's kind of weird because I know there's a picture in a Universal Monster book I've got that shows somebody on the set equipping Lon Chaney Jr. with his mummy belt, they called it, that helped. It was like a lumbar thing.
Oh, okay.
You know, back before anybody knew what that was, but helped distribute the weight of the person when he had to carry all the leading ladies around.
Oh, okay.
So I don't know if they didn't give Christopher Lee a mummy belt. He got the job, but he didn't give him the belt. You know, I don't know. So Karis, you know, walks off with the leading lady with Isabel.
What's he gonna do with her?
He's gonna take her into the tomb, I guess. They're going back to the tomb. That's where he's going. So, and
it's an awful tight little closet.
Yeah. Well, he was in like a, I guess he was in just in a crate though, because I don't know.
He's a little cabin.
Yeah, but he wasn't going back to the house, so I don't. That's where they thought he was going back to the house, but he ended up going to the swamp. But then the posse finally shows up. Suddenly there's like 20 guys with guns.
Yeah.
It's like, geez, man, what the heck? You guys are running a little late, guys. And then the look on Karis's face when she tells him to put her down, you know, it's just so, you know, it's like, okay, because you asked me to, I will. You know, I mean, yeah. It's just like this total subjective, you know, that he's, you know, I'm, you know, okay. Because it's you, I'll do it. You know, I mean, it's like this just complete, he's in love with this woman, and he thinks that's, you know, his love, and he's going to do whatever she asks, even, you know, it's, you know, blind devotion.
Like you have for me.
That's right, yeah. And then all of a sudden he realizes he darts around and they blow his head off pretty much with all things. I mean, I'm guessing the reason they worked the bullets in the buckshot work this time is because they aimed for his head.
Yeah.
I'm guessing, because you see part of his head kind of go off, you know, but it's very quick. So, what did you think about this one?
I liked this one.
Did you?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Except for the, you know, the issues that I said before, you know.
Yeah.
Push the button above your head, buddy.
Well, you know, there's always things like, you could say, well, why didn't they do this and why didn't they do that?
But as it stands,
I think this one is, I said it's very underrated. I wouldn't say it's very underrated. I think it's held in pretty good regard amongst Hammer movie fans. But I think that I would put it up with the Curse of Frankenstein at the least. I'd put Horror of Dracula a little bit above it. But I think it stands with Curse of Frankenstein. And in fact, I might like it just a little bit more. I haven't seen Curse of Frankenstein in a while. But I think it does a good job. It combines the sophisticated but kind of slow elements of Karloff's mummy film, which really, if you look at it, it's basically a remake of Dracula.
Mm-hmm.
And then the fun, action-oriented, but somewhat, as we said before, brain-dead Lon Chaney Jr. Karis films. When they started aiming those pretty much at kids,
right?
You know, or like teenagers and stuff, they were churning them out like sausage. They were, you know, they were very repetitive, very formulaic, but they're a lot of fun. And in fact, you know, I mean, if I'm going to sit in and watch a mummy movie, as much as I love Boris Karloff, who's great in that movie,
mm-hmm.
If I'm going to watch a mummy movie, I want to see a mummy stalking people and stuff. If I'm going to watch a Universal one, I'm probably going to put in one of the Chaney movies
mm-hmm.
and watch that. Speaking of which, it borrowed elements from the original Mummy and the Mummy's Tomb, which is the third film, the first one with Chaney as Karis, more than the other films, although it cherry-picked elements from all of them. The ending is very similar to the Mummy's Ghost, but the outcome is far less tragic, because in that one, the reincarnated princess goes down with Karis, and as they're going in the swamp, she actually turns into a mummy. And so she like dries up and turns into a mummy as they're going into the swamp.
And what's that in?
That's in The Mummy's Ghost. Mm. That's one of the Chaney movies. And in the next one, you see her arise from the swamp. It's one of the eerier moments in a Universal movie, kind of up there with the beginning of Frankenstein Meets the Wolfman that we talked about last time. You see her come up out of the swamp. It looks like literally like she's coming to life. You know, it's interesting. It's like the whole deal with she really is the reincarnated princess in that one, and it's interesting. But man, that was a downer the way that one ended. It's like the girlfriend just goes down in the swamp with him, and that's the end of the movie. I mean, it's like wow, that's a Debbie Downer of an ending. One thing they didn't borrow was the Tana leaves. You know, you brew three, and he's he'll do what you want. You brew too many, and he goes nuts and uncontrollable. So, and they left out, although there are some things we brought up, the huge continuity gaffes. Like I was telling you, if I remember this right, and the mummy's ghost, when they go down into the swamp, the movie is set in New England. When they come up out of the swamp and the mummy's curse, it's in Louisiana. Somehow the setting is changed.
Well, that's right.
And there's a lot of time jumping in those movies. Somebody estimated that if you follow the timeline, the movie, you know, none of the movies, the last movie was made in 1944. It should be taking place in like 1998 or something. Because they keep saying 30 years later, 30 years later, and stuff like that.
Oh, yeah.
And by the time you get to the last one, it should be like 1998, and this movie's made in 1944. It's like 50-some years later. It's really strange. You know, it's been said that Lee apparently wasn't fond of this role, much like Chaney before him. And you can't really blame him because of all the injuries he had.
Right.
But you can't, like I said, you can't tell it by his performance. It's a tour de force for him. It's... Not only is he, of course, physically intimidating because he's incredibly tall.
Tall is he, actually?
I don't know. I don't know what his height was. You know, I'm sure he, as you get older, you shrink.
Right, right.
But I don't know in his youth how tall he was. But he was like at least 6'4" or something like that. But because his autobiography was like Tall, Dark, and Gruesome, I think was the name of his autobiography. Oh, wow. So, but this is, this just shows... You know, not that anybody needed to know that, but this proves his acting chops. And this, I mean, if he can act the way he does through all that makeup, then he was a hell of an actor. So, Hammer did several other mummy films: The Curse of the Mummy's Tomb, The Mummy Shroud, and Blood from the Mummy's Tomb. A lot of stuff coming from the Mummy's Tomb.
Mm-hmm.
But this is the best one, and it's the only one with Cushing and Lee. And it's kind of odd because despite the deal with Universal and the fact that he returned over and over in the Universal films, Hammer's version of Chorus never resurfaced. Resurfaced, literally.
Yeah.
So, well, that'll do it for the movie portion. When we come back, it's clobbering time!
The Fantasticast is your guide to the Fantastic Four from the beginning of the Marvel Age of Comics in 1961 onwards.
Each week, Steve Lacy and Andy Leyland cover every issue, spin-off, guest appearance and cameo, and more.
And in 2015, we begin our journey through the decade that Taste forgot, the 1970s.
Join us as we take a look at...
The departure of Jack Kirby and Stan Lee.
The Kree-Skrull War.
The arrival of Marvel Team-Up.
Bill Murray as the Human Torch.
Creators including Roy Thomas, George Perez, Marv Wolfman, Jerry Conway, Rich Buckler and John Byrne.
And of course, Marvel 2-in-1.
All this and more at ffcast.libsyn.com and on iTunes and Stitcher.
The Fantastic Cast.
Insert catchy tagline here. Wait, what?
Okay, we're back, and our mummified comic this time is Marvel 2-in-1 number 95 from January 1983, according to Mike's Amazing World of Comics, on sale September 28th, 1982. In case you didn't know, Marvel 2-in-1 was a team-up title starring The Thing, which began with a January 1974 cover date, and it won't be too long before Steve and Andy over at the Fantastic Cast get around to covering this title. So, by this point in 1974, when it started, Marvel had finally figured out that The Thing was the most popular and iconic member of the FF, not the Human Torch. The FF, of course, being the Fantastic Four. The Torch had had a solo series in Strange Tales in the 60s, and if you want to find out about that, listen to early episodes of the Fantastic Cast and realize that... Yes, even in the Marvel Age of Comics, they put out some crap.
and dropped LSD a lot.
Yeah.
Woo.
He had started out as the regular guest star with Spider-Man in the early days of Marvel Team-Up, which was Marvel's first Team-Up title, which began with a March 72 cover date. So based on the success of Marvel Team-Up, which quickly dropped the Torch as the consistent Spidey co-star, they started a team-up title with The Thing. Marvel 2-in-1 lasted until issue number 100, which was dated June 1983, and at that point, The Thing got his own solo title. Around that time, team-up titles were starting to go out of vogue. The Brave and the Bold ended right around that exact same time. I think they were on like issue 197 when Marvel 2-in-1 ended, and ended at 200. So they had about 3 months left. And Marvel team-up ended in just a few years. So the cover to this issue we're looking at, which is number 95, is by regular Marvel 2-in-1 artist Ron Wilson and inked by Chick Stone.
Not Tim Wilson, Ron.
Not Tim Wilson, no. It depicts the book's co-stars, The Thing and The Living Mummy, in battle with many large green snakes in a desert setting. Over to the right of the cover are two floating, glowing figures in ancient Egyptian garb. To the right is a miscolored red-headed woman in a stereotypical archaeologist outfit of a khaki shirt, shorts, and a pith helmet, and large stone blocks float in the background. It should be pointed out that the ever-present Marvel corner box has portraits of the Thing and the Living Mummy, and the Mummy is far creepier looking here than he is within the comic or on the cover. Special shout-out to Rob Kelly for his help on this one. So we'll get into the story. Stan Lee, of course, presents... Stan Lee presents The Thing and the Living Mummy, the power to live, the power to die, Excelsior! Not really. David Anthony Kraft, scripter... Alan Kupperberg, penciler, John DiAgostino, inker, Diana Albers, letterer, George Rosasos, colorist, Tom DeFalco, editor, Jim Shooter, Pharaoh. And yes, that's what it actually says.
Well, there you go. Our story begins in the New York studio of blind sculptress Alicia Masters, girlfriend of Benjamin J. Grimm, a.k.a. The Thing. The Rocky hero has just taken a package from mailman Willie Lumpkin, and refused to tip him, slamming the door in his face. Ben informs Alicia the package is addressed to her, and a note says it is to be opened by her and her only. Ben is a bit suspicious, but Alicia asks him to read the note inside the envelope as she opens the box. The note reads, "Miss Masters, open the box and become the first in a new race of all-powerful Egyptian gods." With this, Ben orders Alicia to stop, but it's too late. A wave of energy emanates from the box and engulfs Alicia. Despite Ben's protest, Alicia is unable to stop herself from removing the box's contents, a large red and yellow headdress. She places it on her head and proclaims herself as the Chosen, the Bride of Nephrus. Am I pronouncing that correctly?
I guess. We'll call it Nephrus. Clearly not herself, Alicia blasts Ben when he tries to remove the headpiece, knocking him out of her apartment into the room next door. Possessed by her new chapeau, Alicia stalks off. When Ben revives, he is unable to find her, and the note enclosed has turned to dust. Seeking any clue to her whereabouts, Ben heads to the Metropolitan Museum of Art. There he meets with stuffy Egyptologist and museum curator Lillian Templeworth.
The roughly hewn Ben and aristocratic Templeworth hit it off as would be expected. When Ben mentions the Bride of Nephrus, Templeworth produces a photo of the headpiece, which Ben identifies. How on the nose is that? But anyway.
Yes.
The crown had recently been stolen by Gamal Hassan, former chief curator of the museum's Egyptian division. As his former assistant, Templeworth knows Hassan is one of the foremost experts in Egyptology, and quite mad. She fears Hassan will use Alicia to discover a power stone he believes lies in the ancient ruins of his familiar ancestors and use that power to become a god.
Meanwhile, on a pier in New York, the mind-controlled Alicia conjures an ancient Egyptian boat, and with a mysterious man dressed in Egyptian finery, flies away. Just another night in the Marvel Universe. Back at the museum, Templeworth points to the area in Egypt where Hassan and Alicia may be headed. With that, the ever-loving blue-eyed Thing and his new blue-blooded friend are headed for the land of the pharaohs.
In the Egyptian sand sits a mummy, a living mummy. This mummy, Ninkantu?
Mm-hmm.
Sounds like incontinence, but anyway.
good thing he's got all those bandages on him, right?
Yeah, see, there you go. Recalls how he was a warrior king of Swarlilis.
I guess.
You'll have to forgive my pronunciation. It sucks, but there you go. Anyway, how the high priest Nefarious had cursed him through a special embalming process. Now unable to die, but forced to live for 3,000 years entombed in the desert, he seeks only the power to become human once more, or to end his tortured existence.
Ninkantu?
I don't know. I'm telling you, Ninkantu.
Klaatu, Varada, Nektu. Nektai. Ninkantu is awakened from his flashback by a sight from his past. an ancient ceremonial caravan, and inside, a man who greatly resembles his old foe, Nephrys. Alicia is also aboard, still wearing her headgear and a pointy metal bra that would make Madonna envious, and very little else.
Mm-hmm.
Gamal Hassan, having assumed the attire of Nephrys, is headed to the home of his ancestors. There he believes Alicia's wonderful, sensitive hands will help find the secret to immortality. And if nothing else, he may get something out of the deal on the side. Ow.
Arriving at the ruins, the still-brainwashed Alicia feels a great power and no doubt a little bit of a chill because she is mostly naked. Hassan orders Alicia to transport their slaves away with her magical crown of Hathor. Now they can set about finding the key to Nephrys' power. Not far away, in an Egyptian city straight out of Raiders of the Lost Ark, Lillian Templesworth convinces Ben to put on some stereotypical Egyptian robes so he will blend in better. Yeah, that's going to help. Fearing Hassan's spies are watching them. As if in answer, their duo is attacked by knife-wielding assassins from Central Casting. Of course, the Thing makes short work of them, and the two are soon riding rented camels toward the ruins, one of whom probably won't survive hauling the Thing's large butt around.
At those ruins, Alicia feels the power within her grow and heads toward its source. Hassan heads to a bank of monitors in his tent.
Okay.
Think about that. And sees Ben and Templeworth approaching. He fires some strange cannons at them, which spooks their camels and shreds Ben's burnoose. As a perturbed Hassan observes their survival, he is shocked to find the form of Ninkantu, the living mummy, enter his tent. The mummy believes Hassan to be Nephrys himself, and Hassan believes this has to be some trick of Templeworth for some reason. He is nuts, after all.
Hmm.
As the embodiment of his long-hated foe runs away, Ninkantu feels a great power nearby. Behind two stones in the wall, Alicia has discovered the spirit gem of Nephrys. Hassan grabs the gem and somehow places it on his chest. 3M command strip?
I don't know. Maybe it's just because he's sweaty and it sticks.
Yeah, I don't know. Proclaiming he is now a god.
As Ben and Templeworth approach the camp, they spot Ninkantu, but before they can fully fathom the sight of a living mummy, Hassan and Alicia burst from the ground with a blast of incredible energy. Nephrys has possessed Hassan's body and destroyed his soul in the process. In his usual eloquent fashion, the Thing attacks by throwing a boulder at the newly minted deity. As Nephrys arises from this assault, Ninkantu demands he use his power to free him from his living prison. Nephrys recognizes his old foe and denies him the peace he desires. He turns his attention back to Ben and finds his rocky hide sturdier than he imagined. He continues to blast away at the rocky hero until Templeworth grabs a convenient mirror in the desert from somewhere and reflects the blast back to Nephrys, temporarily blinding him.
Ninkantu devises a plan to steal the gem from his foe's chest and use its power to free himself from his eternal torture. Meanwhile, Templeworth frees Alicia by throwing one of the tattered electrical cables at the energy field surrounding her.
Alicia, now back in her right mind, is reunited with Ben, while Ninkantu roughs up the still-dazed Nephrys. Unable to understand the ancient Egyptian language the mummy speaks, Ben still gets the gist of it and joins him in battling the new god. But Nephrys has many tricks up his sleeve, producing first spears, then snakes, out of thin air and setting them upon the two unlikely allies. Templeworth urges Alicia to use the crown of Hathor, and because comics, the blind sculptor somehow knows how to release a blast of power that severs the gem from Nephrys' chest.
As Nephrys falls hard to the sandy ground below, his constructs disappear and Ben grabs the flying gem. He is shocked to see Nephrys' body aging. The dying madman begs Ben to give the gem back so he may live, but it's too late. Both the body of Nephrys and the gem crumble into dust. Ben embraces Alicia while Templeworth retrieves the crown of Hathor. For in Cantu, he can only dream of the peace his old foe just achieved and wanders off into the desert once more. Okay.
Good night, Almighty. Where to begin?
Well, let's begin with a little background info on the living mummy. The Living Mummy first appeared in Supernatural Thrillers number 5, August 1973. He was created by Steve Gerber and Rich Buckler, and he was yet another addition to Marvel's then very popular horror stable. based on classic literary and movie monsters, so he was Marvel's mummy.
Okay.
He became the regular cover feature in the title, beginning with issue number 7 and continued through issue number 15, so a pretty short run. After that,
There's a reason for that.
After that, he became an infrequent guest star in Marvel comics like this. He was, he wasn't a very common guest star. He just showed up occasionally. Incanti was actually...
Incontinence
was actually entombed alive and was left immortal, but immobile. So he was conscious through his 3,000 years of entombment. So no wonder he was ticked off when, the immobilization...
finally wore off,
and he was released into the modern 70s of the time. You know, he obviously has a lot in common with Karis, although I really didn't know that. I didn't know a whole lot about him. I remember seeing him in, there's a Captain America comic book he's in. You know, I knew of him, but I don't know if other than that Captain America book I'd ever read a story with him, but I saw, I was looking for a mummy comic to talk about, and I'm like, hey, this will mix things up. We haven't done a Marvel 2-in-1, so we haven't done a whole lot with the Fantastic Four, so. Getting into the story itself, in Alicia's studio, we see some of her sculptures. She's got masks of Ben and her creepy stepdad, the Puppet Master, which is, an unfinished statue of Ben and a statue of Reed Richards, which I always think is interesting. She's always got statues of different Marvel characters around. So, now, Alicia has been Ben's girlfriend for years.
Mm-hmm.
The Fantastic Four's identities are publicly known, other than outside of Strange Tales, where Johnny was the only person who thought he had a secret identity. Just ask Steve and Andy. Again, it's those stories are just insane. She knows that the villains, the FF's enemies, have struck at them through their family and friends before. Yet she opens a package
that says "Open on by yourself" and open. What? I'm sorry, but she deserved to get possessed. There, putting it there.
So, of course, then she attacks Ben, blasts him, and all that stuff. Ben, he conveniently knows the exact right place to go. For information on this. And
guess what? It's exactly the guy that used to work there and his old assistant's there. I mean,
Yeah. I imagine Lillian Templewood sounds like a female Thurston Howell.
She looks like a female Thurston Howell.
She even has her jaw jutted out like this.
I'm sorry, but wow.
I could cut through steel with this thing, darling. I mean, it's just... like,
dang!
She must think Ben's a Yale man,
And his bestial...
Yes.
He
was a big, bulging beast of a man. In a pair of blue trunks.
It's just like,
Yeah.
Well, I'm not going to act out... I understand being reserved, but she's, now just calm down and don't touch nothing, okay?
Yeah. Yeah, she's like all the time, like, don't touch anything in the museum, It's like, how does Templeworth know why Hassan has taken Alicia? Because she acts like, did you say she was blind and a sculptress? It's like...
What does that have to do? I mean, why did he pick Alicia?
Because of her sensitive fingers.
And he used them sensitive fingers for something else. Because she got changed from her dress into that little skimpy bikini deal.
There's a lot of skin showing.
Oh,
in this,
my gosh.
For a code-approved comic in the 80s.
It shows her hips and,
Yeah, all she's got is the bullet bra and the metal bullet bra and just a... like a loincloth thing hanging down in the...
It's just covering the very naughty bit.
Yeah.
I mean, the naughty of the naughty. That's it.
Yeah. Of course, Templeworth knows exactly where the ruins are as well. So
yes,
it's like...
of course.
Everything's conveniently set up. Ben goes one place and, it's like... you think with all the doodads that Reed Richards has... he could have went back to the Baxter building, got some kind of PKE meter or whatever, or something.
Well,
whatever.
You would think, if they're going to have all these people and they're always getting kidnapped, why didn't you just have a tracking device in their tooth? Just go ahead and implant it. You're going to be my girlfriend here. Have a tooth tracker. There you go.
Yeah, good point.
I mean, why not?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Of course, we get recapped all we need to know about Incantu, but, I can understand that because,
right.
He hadn't been seen in years and most people didn't know who he was. So, You know, why not? They needed to, actually, and it works. Now, according to the Marvel Wiki, okay, there was another descendant of Nephrys within the Living Mummy series itself named Professor Alexei Scarab, which is cute. You know, Scarab. Uh-huh. It's spelled S-K-A-R-A-B, but, you know, come on. But why didn't they just use that guy? I mean, you know, why make up this Hassan guy? Because as far as I know, Hassan, this is the one and only appearance of Hassan and Miss Templeworth, which is interesting because she's like the only person in this comic that does anything, really.
Yeah.
When they get to the ruins.
Back up, though.
Okay.
When they're in the Egyptian city and stuff, number one, why on earth didn't she go ahead and have Ben get dressed in Egyptian garb before they got to the city, the street scene?
Yeah, in the middle of town.
Yeah, you know, because, you know, that kind of scene coming in.
Yeah.
Kind of noticeable.
Yeah, yeah.
And number two, when she's in the fight, she's got this huge knife in her hand that apparently is so sharp, all she has to do is touch a rope and it just magically cuts through. Because remember, the camels take off.
Right.
And, you know, Ben catches them and stuff, but the knife is so sharp. I mean, she's just walking around and it's that sharp. I mean, it's, you know, come on.
Hey, she was in a rough neighborhood, so, you know, I guess. But, yeah, that whole scene was just like...
Oh, that was, uh-uh.
Yeah, that was, I mean, this was after Raiders of the Lost Ark came out, unless this was an inventory story or something that had been sitting around for a while, which wouldn't surprise me because this was the end of Marvel 2-in-1's run. I don't know that, but it just seems odd that they put this very minor character in a team-up book this late in the game, especially so long after he was had a series.
Yeah,
but it might have been a copyright thing. They might have said, we need to put him in a comic so we can keep him copyrighted.
Oh, well, that's true.
You know, that happens, so... but when they get to the ruins, it looks more like a concrete bunker out in the desert, which is weird. And there's these tents
here's the other thing. It's supposed to be the hidden ruins.
Yeah.
And so, but there's already a concrete bunker there.
Right.
It's hidden ruins, but for some reason there's already, you know, there's equipment there.
There's an above ground. Well, I think that equipment was his, but it's really strange. We'll get to that in a minute. That part was really weird.
Going back to the camels.
Yeah, the camel. How is the camel, Ben's camel, not instantly dead?
I mean, how does he get carried anywhere by anything without going...
Yeah, I mean, they even made a couple visual gags of that in the movies, Fantastic Four movies. So, yeah, that was kind of interesting. Hassan has laser cannons in his tent.
Of course he does.
Or maybe they're in the temple. You can't really tell. I mean, the artwork just shows him coming out of the top of something.
Maybe Dr. Doom left him there?
Right.
You know? I don't know.
He's got him on loan.
Yeah, why not?
He rented him. And the guy's just, I mean, it's like this guy is supposed to be, he's an Egyptologist, he's a museum curator. There's nothing anywhere that says he's this big tech whiz that should have, you know, all this Marvel Universe armament.
Right.
You know, I mean, is he getting stuff like, you know, is
I'm telling you, he got it at Dr. Doom's garage sale.
Or, you know, did Tony Stark have a rummage sale or something? Yeah, I don't know, you know. Of course, that's pretty common in Marvel comics, but still, it just kind of sticks out here, especially because they're in the desert and it either comes out of a tent or atop of an old tomb. So what did he do? I mean, if he put it in, how did he get it to come out of a tent like that? Because it looks like it's coming out of something solid.
Mm-hmm.
And if it's in the ruins, then if he could take the time to build laser cannons in the top of his ruins, why the hell couldn't he find that gem on his own? Maybe spend less time installing laser cannons and more time looking for the gem on your own. When the mummy comes in on Nephrys, you think that would have been a big reveal, but it's this tiny little panel.
Oh, yeah. It's like...
The artwork is very compact. It's like very rigid in a like 7-9 panel grid throughout the comic, which is... It's very strange. We'll get into that at the end of it, but it's weird. And, you know, like we said, Alicia's sensitive fingers do the
work. And again, you know, she did get, you know, dressed in that new outfit. You know, kind of makes you wonder how much time passed. And how he knows about her sensitive fingers. Her fingers do the walking.
Yeah. Ooh, wow. So, again, how does that gem stick to his chest? I mean, if they had, you know, had like a little... He's got, of course, he's got the ring, like, you know, collarbone necklace thing around his neck.
Right.
You know, that you see common to Egyptian garb. If he had, like, a place to put, like, a
gemstone or a
scarab or something, you could see him, like, popping it in there. But no, he just sticks it to his bare chest. And, of course, Nephthys takes over Hassan's body because that's what you do when you're an ancient ancestor and you're greedy. Descendant comes trying to, you know, become your, you know, the modern-day version of you. You know, because it's written in stone. The mummy asks Nephthys to cure him or free him, and when he refuses, he just goes and sits down.
I know, he's just like...
There's a panel of him while Ben's fighting Nephthys. He's like over in the background with his head hanging between his knees, just stand on a dune in the desert like, nobody likes me, I got a rock. You know what I mean? It's like, I just want to die. Yeah, I just want to die. It's Larry Talbot, you know. Like we said before, Templeworth does more in this story than the Thing, and definitely does more than the mummy, who does absolutely nothing of consequence.
I mean, the mummy could have not been in the story, and you never would have known the difference.
That's true.
You know,
yeah,
it created no difference at all.
No, it was just. I think it was the vehicle to have this story. I mean, I'm sure it was like, let's team up the Thing and the living mummy, but. They you know, built this story around Nephthys and this and that, but they could have just, as written, they could have took him out and you never would have known the difference, which is the total, because I'm sure the idea of putting him in it came first. Maybe the story came first and they put him in it. I don't know, but it would seem to be the other way. So Templeworth finds a convenient mirror, and it could have been in a tent, I guess. And a loose electric...
Because she went and run and got it. Because, I mean, it's a big-ass mirror. This is on the dresser.
Yeah.
And, you know, come on!
It's not a shaving mirror. It's a big old mirror.
It's a big-ass women's dresser mirror. I'm like, what the crap?
Well, Nephthys is pretty vain. I mean, Hassan or Nephthys, because, you know, he is running around shirtless with his pecs showing, so maybe he likes to have a big mirror around. But she also finds a loose electrical cable.
Which doesn't kill her when she picks it up.
Yeah. Presumably it's from the laser cannons that were somehow destroyed when they come up through the ground.
But apparently it was still live enough because when she takes it and hits Alicia with it.
Yeah.
It's a live wire.
Yeah.
And here's the thing. She's like, oh, she's falling 20 feet. Well, dumbass, why didn't you think about that before you stuck it up there?
And she catches her. So
yeah.
Just like the stuffy, I mean, I don't know how old this woman's supposed to be, but she looks like she's at least in her
50s.
No, she looks like she's at least in her 50s.
Good. Yeah.
At least. Maybe
her late 40s anyway.
Yeah. And she's like, you know, woman of action, which is cool in a way, but it's like, nothing has told us that this woman should be capable of, you know, being, I mean, she, you know, if they were dropping little hints, even if she said little asides like, oh, this is nothing, you should have been with me when I was in blah, blah, blah. But we just get...
I'm Laura Croft's grandmother, bitch.
Yeah. basically. But, yeah, we get no idea about that, so it's like, okay. Okay, the mummy does rough Nephthys up a bit, but that's it. And the panels are so tiny, you kind of just forget it.
Yeah, it's pointless.
And even though Alicia is herself again, she somehow knows how to work the crown, which makes no sense. And then, you know, she blasts Hassan, Nephthys, and she blasts the gem off of him. He falls to the ground, Ben grabs the gem, and then his body starts to age. Why? Is it because the gem used up his body? Because it was separated? But this isn't Nephthys. This is Hassan. This isn't Nephthys brought back to life. He might have possessed Hassan's body.
No, but remember he said when it was the price of his soul, so there was no soul in there.
Yeah, but it's still Hassan's body. So it's not like it's an ancient body reanimated. It's Hassan's body with Nephthys' soul in it.
I think because of all the mystical energy that was used, you could make that argument that that's what burned it up.
Why'd the gem crumble? I mean, what made it crumble?
Because of the power from Alicia, the cramp, you know.
I guess, but it was just kind of like, okay. And then Ben and company just let the mummy wander off.
Yeah, you know, why
not? He's a living mummy. I mean, wouldn't Ben assume this guy could be trouble and at least try to take him with him to find out if he's going to be trouble?
Yeah.
Like, what's his deal? What's your backstory? Maybe maybe Stretch-O can help you, you know? I mean, you know, no, they just let him wander off back into the desert. Yeah. It's like they don't ask any questions. I mean, if there was a panel of Ben saying, hey, you know, hey, buddy, come back here, you know, or something like that. And Alicia going, no, Ben, let him go. You know, leave him to his tortured existence or
something,
you know.
Yeah.
No, there's nothing. I mean, there's a panel of them standing there and he wanders off. And that's the end of the story. This story it's wackier than crap.
Mm-hmm.
It's a fun distraction, as most team-up comics were, but the leaps of logic in it are very Silver Age-y.
The leaps of logic are Olympian in nature.
Olympic record-breaking. There's been some debate over on one of my favorite shows, Back to the Bins, as to whether DC had a Silver Age. It's been pointed out that they still publish very Silver Age-y stuff more often than not, way up until Crisis, especially with certain characters, and that they would have periods of kind of Bronze Age, but then they go back to Silver Age, like Superman, you know, like he eventually went back to being, you know, a newspaper reporter, and some of the stories got almost Silver Age gimmicky before they rebooted in the mid-80s. I think that you can say that that can apply to Marvel, too, because it feels like that here. Not only could this have no living mummy in it, this could have easily been published in a Fantastic Four annual backup story in the 60s and just be like a thing solo story. Mm-hmm. I mean, it feels very, very Silver Age-y. David Anthony Kraft, who was the writer, he had long runs on the original Savage She-Hulk title and the Defenders. He did a lot of journeyman work at Marvel and DC. And after this, he had a fairly long but not very well received at all run on World's Finest.
Mm.
Yeah, I kept buying that book thinking it's got to get better, and it just wouldn't. He did publish a comic magazine called David Anthony Kraft's Comic Interview during the 80s as well, which I bought quite a few issues of here and there. So, Paul Kupperberg, who unfortunately just recently passed away, he always seemed like a really solid artist to me. He was another creator that bounced between comics a lot, although he was a regular artist on Blue Devil just a few years after this. But I hate to say this, but his work in this issue seems pretty uninspired. It's in a little rushed. I mean, it feels cramped. I'd blame it on the inks of the inker, Joe DiAgostino.
It's the story layout itself.
Yeah, it's the layout seems very, you know, maybe there was too much story. I mean, we talk about, you know, decompressed comics nowadays and the comics were much more compressed back then. But you know, this is too compressed. All the action in this story is compromised by tiny, tiny panels.
Right.
I mean, there's none of this bombastic Marvel style.
Where's
you know?
The Kirby crackle?
Right, exactly. Where's the clobbering time? There's
yes.
not a single clobbering time
You're
in
right.
this comic. So, yeah, there's no, none of that. And Marvel was still very much, especially in Fantastic Four type books, still very much mindful of that Kirby energy. John Byrne was doing the Fantastic Four right now and had brought, you know, a lot of that back. So they were very mindful of that. So this is kind of strange. I don't know if this was done Marvel method where he got the plot and he drew it and, you know, because the early part of the comic is paced out a little bit better. The panels are a little bit bigger. There's more excitement in the brief battle between Alicia and Ben in her apartment than there is between Ben, the mummy, and Nephris mm-hmm. at the end. So it's almost like he paced it poorly. Like he left the beginning of the story, left it room to breathe, and then when he got, oh crap, I've only got 5 pages left. Check.
Joink.
Yeah, which can happen. I mean, maybe that's not what happened, but it just, I like Kupperberg's stuff in other places, but I was, so when I saw, oh, Alan Kupperberg, this will be good. I was disappointed in it, I'll be honest with you, because I do like his stuff. He did some Justice League a few years later. He did a few issues of Justice League. He did some good work, too. He did actually draw one issue of Supernatural Thrillers with the Living Mummy, which was issue number 11. So he did have some experience
with the Living
Mummy. So that might be. He had done a few fill-ins on this title. He was kind of one of those guys that did just, you know, show up in a fill-in here and there.
Oh, yeah.
He was just kind of,
hey, I got the flu. Can you fill in for me?
Yeah. I mean,
you know,
some of those guys, that's how they made their living. He was working on Marvel's Crazy magazine and come up with the character Obnoxio the Clown, who was somewhat popular there for a while. I, you know, this was kind of fun. It's like a fun, you know, fun read, but it's just nuts. I mean, it's nuts. What did you think of it?
You know, it's your typical Silver Age-y Marvel. Oh, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, but published in 1983.
I know, but you know.
Yeah, right. So, yeah. Well, I think that'll about wrap it up for this episode of Superman. Had to say it, sorry.
Uh-huh.
So, join us next time and we'll make one final trip. We'll brave one final journey.
Into the house of Frankenstein.
For this year. And we'll be talking about Return of the Vampire. Starring Bela Lugosi. So another Bela Lugosi movie, but this time Bela gets to shine, because he did not get to shine in Frankenstein Meets the Wolfman.
No.
So join us then, and we'll have a special, very super cool comic. I'm really excited to talk about this one, but I'm not going to tell you what it is. Actually, it's two comics. It's two issues. So it's going to be, we'll blow it out, baby. One last House of Frankenstein episode.
For 2015.
So we'll see you then. Bye.
Bye.
Supermates is a Franklin and Franken production in association with Bugaloo Enterprises Worldwide. The characters and properties mentioned in this show are copyright their respective holders. Likewise, all audio clips are copyright their holders and no infringement is implied. So please don't sue my mommy and daddy. Emails can be sent to supermatespodcast@gmail.com. Comments can be left at our blog at supermatescomic.blogspot.com. Find us on Facebook by searching for Supermates Podcast. Please consider leaving a review on iTunes. Thank you for listening to Supermates, the husband and wife geek cast.
It's always there.